Welcome to Saving the Game. This is episode 2 of Saving the Game, Alignment, recorded July 10th, 2012, with your hosts, Grant and Peter.
Welcome to Saving the Game. I'm Peter.
And I'm Grant.
Tonight's topic is alignment. We're going to be discussing mechanics for morality in role-playing games and how they can affect events at the gaming table and kind of our opinions on them from a Christian point of view.
Right. How to bring some of your Christian morality and Christian choices into an alignment system that may not on the surface seem to support that. Now, before we get into that, we have one fairly significant announcement. A friend of ours, Brandon, is going to be, sometime in the next few episodes, subbing in for me for at least a couple of episodes while I deal with the arrival of our firstborn, Rachel, who should be here. Let's see, we're recording this on July 10th. She will be here probably no later than August 14th, so I've got 5 weeks to get ready. And in 5 weeks, gonna have a baby. Hard to record while I've got a baby.
Yeah, and we wouldn't expect you to, so Brandon
My wife wouldn't expect me to.
Yeah. In fact, I would imagine your wife would expect you to not record for at least the first few weeks.
Yeah.
And from what I know of new parents, it's doubtful that you would have the energy to do so, even if you had carte blanche from your wife.
No, we'll be exhausted. I will not be bringing a lot of interesting conversation other than diapers.
Any interesting conversation you've got left will probably be reserved for your coworkers, and rightly so.
Yeah. Well, no, hopefully wife, then coworkers.
Well,
then you guys.
Yeah, that's true. I suppose you don't really need to be an interesting conversationalist to be a software tester. You just need to be able to spot bugs.
Pretty much, yeah.
Not to diminish what you do for a living, but...
No, that's fine. It's software testing and software support now. I'm kind of wearing two hats, transitioning away from testing into support.
Oh, is that a good thing?
Yeah.
Good.
It is. It's a different kind of puzzle solver, which is nice. Rather than solving problems with new code, we're solving problems in a customer environment with the code that we've got. It's a different kind of problem, different kind of puzzle to solve, but it's still interesting.
Oh, good. I hope that works out well for you.
I hope so, too.
Should we get into our topic?
I think so. But first, we've got a particular piece of scripture that you found for us. Why don't you go ahead and give us that?
All right, it's 2 Corinthians 5:17. Therefore, if anyone is in Christ, he is a new creation. The old has passed away, behold, the new has come. And that's from the ESV. The relevance of that will probably become very obvious as we go on into our episode a little bit more, but we will call back to this later just to kind of drive it home, I think.
Now, for those of you who are tuning in without too much knowledge about role-playing games, first of all, welcome to the podcast. And secondly, let me give you a very quick description of what alignment traditionally is in role-playing games. Alignment is a very simplistic way to describe a character's moral standing, and it's usually a character. It describes it in relative terms. Good, neutral, evil. Lawful, neutral, chaotic. That's sort of the traditional Dungeons & Dragons grid that you use. It's kind of a two-dimensional thing, but there are others. Palladium has principled and scrupled and that sort of thing.
Principled, scrupulous, unscrupulous, anarchist, miscreant, aberrant, and diabolic, from most good to most evil for them.
Right. Fourth edition D&D has a lawful good, good, unaligned, which is essentially neutral, evil, chaotic evil. Essentially, they made a diagonal axis through the old two-dimensional grid that they had.
Most other systems handle morality with things like disadvantages or aspects, which are descriptive things for a specific moral trait. So, for instance, GURPS, my native system that I mentioned in the first episode, uses disadvantages. And a disadvantage in GURPS, by the way, is anything that restricts your character in some way, whether it's considered noble and virtuous, like some of the stuff I'm going to describe, or it's something like your character is blind. Those all fall under disadvantage.
Right. Savage Worlds uses the same thing, in some cases actually on the same character, which is an interesting sort of balance.
Oh yeah, same in GURPS.
The Necessary Evil game that I've talked about before, which is supervillains trying to save the world. There's a lot of opportunity there to have some of the traditionally evil ones, and also have particular moral grounds that you won't cross. You can do a lot with those. It's not a hard and fast alignment, but you get something mechanical that reflects your moral standing, and that's really sort of what we're defining alignment as.
Those say things about people, and interestingly, those could be on the same character. You can have characters that will absolutely tell you the truth and refuse to leave a living enemy behind them. In fact, I can think of some characters that were very noble in one way and kind of scary in others from a fictionalized version of history in Band of Brothers. Spears comes to mind.
I've not seen it, but...
Oh, you should. It's very good. He was an allied officer, an American one, actually, who had this lethal, scary, leave no living enemy behind you sort of reputation, but he was very fair and beloved by his troops, and he was a very good tactician. So there's an example of the kind of moral complexity that you can get when you're not using an alignment system sometimes. But we're kind of getting ahead of ourselves a little bit.
A little bit. Real quick, also, if you've played any sort of semi-role-playing game, video game like Knights of the Old Republic or Mass Effect or Infamous, you'll be familiar also with an alignment system. It goes by different names there, but most of them tend to be one-dimensional. You are good or you are evil, and you have to make different choices in the game to maintain that good or evil state.
Or in some cases, you are very cynical or you're very idealistic.
Sure. Like I said, it takes different names. Generally one-dimensional, though.
Yeah, it's usually just you've got the good and upstanding on one side and the kind of down in the mud on the other. There's not the secondary axis like you normally have in D&D.
Right. And it's interesting to note that most of those never really reward anybody for staying neutral. I remember that being a big complaint about Knights of the Old Republic. You could play a perfectly neutral character, and you never got anything for it.
Yeah, they would be totally hamstrung throughout the entire game.
Yep.
All right, so now that we kind of know what alignments are, or rather our listeners do that didn't before, how does this get used in games? First of all, Grant, how have you used it, or how have you decided that you didn't want to use it in your own personal experience?
Alignment is one of those things where certain systems, most notoriously Dungeons & Dragons, of course, uses alignment as a mechanical part of the game. So many different things in the game react to your alignment or can be used by people of your alignment or have certain effects on this alignment or that alignment, people of any opposite alignment to you, so on and so forth. Alignment is a fairly significant mechanical aspect of 3rd edition and earlier D&D, Pathfinder, a little bit less so in 4th edition, and of course, new edition, D&D Next. No one has any idea, nobody's published anything about alignment so far. I tend to not really like alignment as a rule. I think it tends to oversimplify in a lot of cases.
Yeah, but sometimes simplifying can be good.
It can, and as a descriptor, I don't have much of a problem with alignment.
Yeah, the problem is when it becomes a prescriptor that it really gets annoying.
Right, when it starts to define you instead of you saying, generally I'm this, and here's really how... That's good, but when you just say, yep, I'm right here and I don't want to think about it much more than that, that tends to be a problem.
If you're using it as prescriptive, you've got the 3x3 grid and you're basically just picking which box you're going to drop any given character into.
Yeah, and again, if you're using a different system that doesn't use the D&D 3x3 grid, substitute that in here. That's the one we're going to kind of use as our baseline throughout this conversation.
Yeah. And for those that aren't super familiar with D&D or role-playing games in general, arguments about alignment are, what, about 60% of the arguing that goes on D&D forums, it seems like?
It's a lot of it. The debate is mostly, should you use alignment? That's how I've mostly seen it.
I'll see, because I've always seen stuff about prescriptive or descriptive, and how do you define good, neutral, and evil? Those seem to be the ones that I always run across.
Trying to define good, neutral, and evil is certainly a complicated thing. I can't say that I've really seen that too much. Most of it has been people complaining about the existence of alignment in general or defending it.
Gotcha.
That's the internet for you. People love to argue.
Oh, yeah. All right, so I mentioned that I do like using it sometimes, so I'm going to probably defend my position a little bit here, if you don't mind.
Please do.
So it's useful as a shorthand, as I mentioned before. If you've got kind of a stereotypical legendary hero character that you're playing, it's very easy to put down lawful or neutral good on a character sheet, and allow that to be all the description you need rather than, like, sifting through a lengthy list of character traits and descriptors to look for something that's going to describe what you were planning on doing anyways. Now, I fully realize that the retort to that is, yeah, but if you spend the extra time, you'll have a much more detailed and nuanced description of the character. I get that.
Also, if you don't have any sort of keyword descriptor like that, you have to actually describe the character in detail and give a somewhat more complex thing rather than even just picking descriptive words off a list. Come up with a description of your character that's coherent and isn't manufactured.
Well, and that's where you start getting into things like aspects from fate, which I'd like to discuss in a couple of seconds here.
Sure.
I think alignment is also useful for showing who's on what side, who is and isn't trustworthy, kind of as a lubricant through the plot, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
It's a nice GMing tool when you don't want to have your player characters sitting around paralyzed with indecision, trying to figure out which way they should go, who they should trust, can I listen to this person, that sort of thing. This person shows up as your alignment detecting character, runs their magic alignment detector, and this person shows up as a trustworthy alignment. The story giving NPC gives you the story, and you go off and do the real stuff, where you probably start running into people who are, for whatever reason, harder to figure out than that guy, if you're looking for, like, an intrigue or that sort of thing. But it's nice to be able to be, like, back at the player's base of operations and just have a couple of characters that, yes, this character is genuinely trustworthy, the person is lawful good, for instance, and they will not just send me into a trap for their own selfish glee or something. It's also useful on one other thing. It provides a concrete set of incremental steps in a character's redemption. If you start out with a character that's, say, you know, the worst of the worst, chaotic evil, the burn and pillage alignment, and that character is captured by a group of much more noble souls, talked to and treated well, and slowly coaxed out of the darkness, having them suddenly stop detecting as evil one day is kind of a cool moment.
Yeah, I'll give you that. I like that. I think if you're doing it for your character and you've got a character that you're evolving, they're going through a moral evolution and a moral redemption, those are useful waypoints to illustrate your own progress with that character, and I think that's certainly got some value to it.
This, by the way, listeners, is where we chose to put the scripture quote we did in.
Yes.
Redemption stories are kind of a neat place to use alignment.
Yep, and they're a good way to get started thinking about that redemption story or get some inspiration for it. How do I get from here to here? What sort of character would start here and end up where I want them to end up?
And what kinds of stories can we tell along the way as they move from here to here to here to finally the end point?
Right. Now, this is not to say that alignment systems don't have some inherent problems, and these are why I tend not to like them. The first one, and this is limited mostly to people who aren't used to playing systems or characters with...
You're going to talk about the evil whack-a-mole problem, aren't you?
I'm going to talk about the evil whack-a-mole problem. Specifically, the evil whack-a-mole paladin. The guy who walks around with his detect evil on, and is he evil? Is that evil? Is that evil? I smite the evil peasant doing his job.
Yeah.
You know, the evil baker, who's kind of selfish.
Yeah, the guy is a selfish jerk. He's not supportive to his spouse. He's really greedy. He never gives any of his money away. The Ebenezer Scrooge kind of character.
Yeah. Guess what? He's probably evil, but you don't want to go,
yeah,
evil guy, smite him with the glowing longsword of holiness or whatever you've got.
First of all, that's not a very interesting character. Second of all, that's not a very good thing to do. And third of all, it's obviously not very Christian. There's no semblance of forgiveness or anything in there.
Right. It's an easy way to do it, and frankly, it's annoying for everyone else at the table.
Yeah, using those kinds of abilities as just a targeting assist is about the most shallow, one-dimensional way that you can use them at all.
Targeting assist, and also it's the idea that...
I don't need to know anything else about this guy, what he's done, who he is, what he's trying to become. I just know that he's registering as evil right now, so I kill him.
Right, and it gets into the other issues I have with alignment, the lack of any sort of moral complexity, moral gradient. Yeah, your local baker in the town you're in might be selfish and greedy and unpleasant, and generally not a nice guy. And yeah, he might register as evil, but he's probably not the necromancer raising the undead down in the crypt, threatening to destroy the world.
Yeah.
There's a difference.
For that matter, he's probably not even the leader of the bandits that have been mugging travelers going between your town and the next.
Yeah. There's some significant differences in behavior and depravity. You know, how far gone is this man? And reducing it all to evil, smite it. Evil, smite it, is born. And again, it's not Christian.
No. The other problem that you can run into, which is more of kind of a, in a lot of ways, it's kind of a purely role-playing thing, although some Christian elements can fall in here, is characters that are static and don't change at all. Ever.
Right.
No matter what happens. Now, there are people who seem to be psychologically impervious in the world. I have a very good friend from high school who went off to war in Iraq, got wounded in combat, saw all kinds of horrible things, and as far as I can tell, came back the exact same person. No trace of PTSD, no TBI, still the same basically decent, kind of sarcastic sense of humor person that went off to war. That's very rare. Most people, when they go through the kinds of things that adventurers in a role-playing game go through, will be altered by the experience. And a character whose alignment is locked in place... First of all, alignment is an overly simplistic way of describing human psychology, and I will admit that. But one that doesn't move, ever, no matter what, is even more simplistic and really kind of cheapens some good opportunities that you could have to depict a character that actually feels like a person rather than just a cardboard stand-up.
Right. If you are playing something like Dungeon Crawl D&D game where there's not a lot of character exploration going on, it's all grids and tactics and action economies and that sort of thing.
Yeah, if you're playing basically tabletop Diablo, write the alignment down and go slay some monsters and collect treasure.
Yeah, you're not playing a character-driven game. Go for it.
Yeah.
Do your thing.
Yeah, it's perfectly fine in that. It's, you know, you'll know when, you know, one of your party members casts an area effect spell that only affects monsters that you'll be fine. Great, wonderful.
Yeah. Don't worry about the complexity. That's not what you're there for. That's not how you're having fun that day. But if you're going for a character-driven story or you want to explore character growth and change, static characters aren't that interesting in that sort of a story. Pigeonholing your character ahead of time into a particular moral stance, you're missing the point if you do something like that, and I don't recommend doing that at all.
Now, just to kind of show the other side of the argument, those alignments, whether you're using D&D, Palladium, or even if you're describing out a character's kind of supposed moral standing with disadvantages, can describe a whole range of different kinds of personalities and subtypes within. For instance, kind of a non-stereotypical lawful good character is Roy Greenhill from Order of the Stick. He is sarcastic, he's hard-bitten, he's got a smart remark for everything. He tends to have kind of a very long-suffering and flippant attitude, but he's a decent, honorable person who is loyal to people, who does the right thing because it is the right thing, and generally exemplifies his alignment. There's a lot of other lawful good characters out there that are the stereotypical, no sense of humor, stick in the mud, I only care about my cause or my crusade or that sort of thing. So there can be some variance even within an alignment.
Sure.
It doesn't have to be as one-dimensional as people make it a lot of the time, or two-dimensional in the case of D&D.
One thing that this sort of reflects, though, is occasionally I have seen alignment result in restricted character choices. Now, some of that is mechanical.
And some of that just makes sense.
Sure.
You don't want a super disciplined, like, crazy wild man barbarian from out in the wilds. That wouldn't make sense.
Right. Again, in systems where alignment has strong mechanical purposes, again, Dungeons & Dragons, these make good sense, but it can feel awkward for a lot of people, and I sometimes feel awkward with it. If I say, well, my character is lawful neutral, therefore he wouldn't do something like this, that feels sort of awkward. I really want to have a little more in-depth explanation. Well, this is my character's reasoning, rather than, hey, he sort of falls in this category of people. I want a little more detail and understanding and complexity to a character to explain why they would or wouldn't behave in a particular way.
Yeah, that makes sense. Okay, so a lot of the time you won't want to use alignment in a given game, but you're going to be using something like GURPS or Fate, where there's some more descriptive terms that will kind of address your character's ethics in a little bit more of a flexible way as far as description goes. This is kind of the difference between using a black, white, and gray crayon to draw a sketch of the character's morality and dumping one of those big boxes that you got when you were a kid that had, like, all the colors in it, dumping that on the table.
What do you mean, when you were a kid? I have two of those in my closet.
Well, you have a kid coming.
I do. But those are mine and my wife's.
Okay, fair enough. I haven't used crayons in a while, but...
We're getting another one for her.
Kid's gotta have her own crayons, huh? No touching dad's crayons?
She's not having mine.
Fair enough.
I'm having a hard enough time giving up my Legos as it is, man. Come on.
Oh. Anyway.
Yes, moving on.
Speaking of things that you can explore, build, and create with, there's...
Hey, transitions.
Yes. You know, we've got GURPS in here a little bit, but I think I would rather go straight into Fate, because you've got some experience with this system, and I think the way that Fate handles these aspects of characters is very cool. So why don't you tell our listeners about that a little bit?
Fate is an interesting system. I don't want to quite call it a generic system, because it's mostly used in particular games with varying changes.
I'd call it a generic system that doesn't have a huge catalog of games attached to it yet.
Okay, I'll buy that. Fate... It's a variant of Fudge, sort of an evolution or branch of the Fudge system, where you have aspects for your character, varying numbers depending on the system and character and that sort of thing, that can be tagged or compelled to get advantages or suffer disadvantages or compulsive actions, sort of depending on the interaction back and forth between the players and the groups and the GM. For example, I might have an aspect like overly inquisitive. I might be able to tag that to get a bonus when investigating something, looking into something, trying to get information out of somebody, that sort of thing. Or the GM might use that to compel me to...
Stick your nose where it might get hurt.
Yeah, get in trouble, peek through the window and be seen by the bad guy, any number of things, end up in a bad situation, whatever it is. Maybe get distracted by minutia and not hear somebody come in through the window, what have you. Any number of things, they're innately flexible in that regard. I can use them for good things or bad things. The GM can use them for good things or bad things. It's all about telling an interesting story and having a hook to play off of some of those character actions.
This sort of reminds me of how a lot of the time on my personnel reviews at work, my greatest strengths and greatest weaknesses are two sides of the same coin.
Yes. Any good aspect tends to have that dual nature, where you can use it for something that's good for you or something that's bad for you, really sort of flesh out an interesting, flawed in minor ways, character. Or maybe major ways, but usually, you know, small, interesting flaws.
That's kind of cool because the ethical traits in GURPS are just static disadvantages. You'll have something like Code of Honor, and you'll go through and break out exactly what the code prohibits and what your character won't do.
Right.
And if he does any of those prescribed actions... He'll suffer some kind of penalty for a while as he's kind of racked with guilt and feels ashamed of himself and that sort of thing. But
right.
It doesn't have that kind of neat, the GM can grab onto this like a handle and point your character in a different direction aspect.
Right. The nice thing about aspects in Fate is that they are not punitive. They don't circumscribe your character's actions. They help define how your character might act in ways that are good or bad for you. And when you get compelled to do something, it's good for you in-game. That's one of the ways you get a fate point, which you can then spend to tag an aspect, your aspect or somebody else's aspect, get a bonus, that sort of thing. There's a whole economy of fate points that flows back and forth. But the aspect system is nice, and I've seen a lot of people start adding aspects and similar mechanics to games that lack them. It's a nice way to get an economy of points and bonuses flowing through a game that's otherwise maybe a little static or dull.
Yeah, for sure. I know sometimes you can kind of hand-wave that with disadvantages or D&D-style alignments if you're a skilled enough GM, but boy, having something that's really truly descriptive like that has got to be wonderful to latch onto, both as a GM and as a player.
I admit, in a lot of the games I've played, alignment doesn't matter terribly much. It's very easy to take alignments out of the game as far as character behavior goes and really focus on the complexities of behavior and not try and pigeonhole your character in a particular way.
Well, and I know one way that I've seen that handled before, there's the Arcanus setting for 3rd edition. It was an unofficial setting, but I believe all of their kind of alignment-based magic and class abilities and that sort of thing was set up so that it's more keyed off of the loyalties of a character. It's been a while since I read the books, and it may not have even been there, actually, but I know I've seen it someplace. It's like, you're loyal to this faith or this secret society or this not secret at all society, like a natural army, and therefore this and this abilities will affect this and this group, but not this and this one. I thought that was kind of interesting, where you can still have some of the fun of having something like a Smite Evil or Forbiddance in the game without it being quite so black and white.
That's interesting. I'm going to have to look that up. I know one of the things that originally attracted me to my personal favorite Dungeons & Dragons official settings, which is Eberron, is the fact that the alignment system in Eberron is a lot more flexible and, I don't want to say less meaningful, but it can...
But it is kind of less meaningful in some ways.
In some ways it is.
Not necessarily bad, but it's not a, like, boy, in something like Ravenloft or the Forgotten Realms, it's really there front and center. And
right.
I think in Eberron, your characters are much more defined by their actions and their deeds than by two letters on your character sheet.
Sure, and not just characters, but a lot of the world is defined that way. I remember one classic example here is, traditionally in D&D, clerics can usually turn undead or command undead, either repel them and destroy them, or take control of them and use them, depending on whether you're good or evil. And there's a religious organization in Eberron, the Church of the Silver Flame. And the church itself is a good aligned organization, has plenty of very faithful followers. Its head is lawful evil, because he's particularly selfish, just in it for his own power, that sort of thing.
He's like one of the bad popes.
But he can still turn undead, because he's the head of the Church of the Silver Flame, and that's what he does. His personal alignment is not particularly important compared to, you know, what he stands for.
Yeah. I think that's very good in some ways, too, where, to fall back to scripture a bit, all have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. There is not one righteous, no, not one. And I think sometimes something like the Eberron system is good for people that are trying really hard to live up to a certain moral standard and maybe haven't gotten there yet.
Absolutely. Eberron is built in many ways around complex moral quandaries as opposed to the they're good, they're evil, everybody duke it out sort of things that you might get in Forgotten Realms or other settings like that.
Or Lord of the Rings. I mean, the lines between good and evil were pretty clear for a lot of the characters in that story. You pretty much picked a side.
Really, most of it.
Yeah, you pretty much picked a side.
Yeah.
So we've kind of started to touch on this a little bit, but let's assume that you're going to use an alignment system in the game that you're playing. How, as a Christian, do you define that? Let's leave Law and Chaos out of it for the moment. How do we as Christians define good, particularly with respect to role-playing characters?
Well, that's tricky. I actually was asked a slightly related question today in the comments on our website, SaveTheGamePodcast.org. Plug!
Yeah.
So one of the things I talked about in our introductory episode, an introductory blog post that we had on our website, was I was saying, you know, I don't feel that in the past several years I've been a good Christian. And the gentleman fairly wisely asked me, how do you define a good Christian? How, you know, what makes you think you're not a good Christian? What would make someone else think they are a good Christian? It's a very complicated question. The question, what makes for a good Christian, has been the subject of about 2,000 years of debate and warfare and ecclesiastical bickering. And
countless books have been written on the subject. Countless noses have been bloodied. It's a big deal.
In many ways, that is one of the biggest questions that Christians face, is how do we act as good Christians? How do we become good Christians? There are a few things that I think we all agree on. Belief in God, belief in salvation through Jesus Christ, belief that Jesus was God's Son, fully divine and fully human, and that his death and resurrection, through some manner, redeems each of us and forgives our sins. We believe that sins can be forgiven. Generally, we all believe that we are inherently sinful. A few other major points like that. It's fairly easy, I think, to say that anybody who believes and acts according to generally accepted Christian precepts falls into that good category. Whether or not Christianity is actually in your game or not may depend on the game you're playing, but it's easy to say, okay, if they act sort of like this, they're probably good.
Let's get into the act sort of like this stuff, because I think that's where some of the real meat of this can come in.
Please.
So there's a few places in Scripture that we picked out that kind of describe moral behavior for a Christian. I think probably the most obvious is the fruits of the Spirit. The fruits of the Spirit are love, joy, peace, forbearance, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. That's from Galatians 5:22 and 23. I would say that's a pretty high standard, especially for an adventurer to hold themselves to. But I think that does make a good starting point for what Christian morality actually looks like.
It's important to note that it's not always necessary for a character who is good to live up to all of those all the time. It's important, I think, though, that they generally strive for those, in the same way that we as Christians never live up to all of those all the time. We're inherently sinful. We inherently fail because we are mortal, we're inherently sinful, and the only way we can be fully redeemed and fully cleansed of our sins is through Christ. That's something we're going to see all the time. And thus, it's very realistic for a character to try and be a good person, but not always fail. Or not always, excuse me.
Not always succeed.
Not always succeed.
Yeah, and struggle and fall down and pick themselves up and ask other people for help and really wrestle with this, because I don't know about you, but I do that all the time in my life.
Yeah.
I'll make a decision and look back at it later and be like, boy, that was not the best thing I could have done in that situation, or that was one of the worst things I could have done in that situation sometimes.
Right, and it's not always even through my own best efforts. A lot of times I'm simply not strong enough, not wise enough to make the right decision.
Yeah, or sometimes you hit what I would say is like a threshold of moral frustration, and it's like, being good is too hard. Screw it this time.
Right.
Not something that any of us are proud of, but I think something that all of us have done at least once in our life.
Yes.
So, moving on from there, we also had 1 Corinthians 13:4-8, an elaboration on the love part of the list of the fruits of the Spirit that we went through. Love is patient, love is kind, it does not envy, it does not boast, it is not proud, it does not dishonor others, it is not self-seeking, it is not easily angered, it keeps no record of wrongs. Love does not delight in evil, but rejoices with the truth. It always protects, always trusts, always hopes, always preserves. Love never fails. There's more that goes on from there. It says, but where there are prophecies, they will cease. Where there are tongues, they will be stilled. Where there is knowledge, it will pass away. Once again, that's a really high standard. It's interesting to try and reconcile these, especially with characters that have to go out and physically fight against things. And in fact, I think reading verses like the ones that we have just covered here is one of the reasons why a lot of Christians, I think you and I included, have occasionally had some struggles with where is the appropriate context to actually, like, stand your ground and fight against something? At what point, you know, does Christian warrior become an oxymoron, and at what point is it appropriate? And I think we're going to be addressing that in a forthcoming episode in detail, but that's definitely something that comes up in here. I think we also had a couple other things that we wanted to discuss. Grant, I've been talking a lot lately. Do you want to cover the virtues?
Sure. There are 7 classically Christian virtues derived from a poem, Psychomachia, by Aurelius Prudentius, a Christian governor in the Roman Empire from the late 4th century, if I'm doing my math right there, and eventually developed throughout the Middle Ages by the church and through theological debate, and they end up as the 7 heavenly virtues, counterparts to the, unfortunately, better known 7 deadly sins. Those virtues are chastity, temperance, charity, diligence, patience, kindness, and humility. Those are each one word that stands for a lot of, I don't want to say detailed, but some complex choices that Christians have to make.
And if we're going to point at one good thing that came out of the Middle Ages, this list is definitely a contender.
Yes.
This list is a very useful shorthand, which is why it has endured so long, because it's, I would say, mostly spot on. if you can exemplify that batch of virtues, it's a very good start, at least, towards being a good Christian. Or a good character in a role-playing game.
Absolutely.
I think of special value, if we're going to be discussing the moral standards for a good character, is forgiveness and mercy. I think a lot of the time it's easy to fall into the trap of these merciless, avenging, punisher-like characters that do not give second chances, do not give quarter, dispense a particularly merciless and vicious form of justice, and leave a trail of bodies behind them. Maybe not necessarily people who didn't deserve what happened to them from like a human standpoint, but that's certainly not what I would call a truly virtuous character.
No. Violence is one of those things that...
it's hard to kind of come around to. First of all, it's so ingrained in both role-playing games and in the world, where sometimes you do have to employ violence to stop something worse evil from happening. The classical example that everybody in modern history always goes back to is World War II. The Nazis were not going to stop unless somebody stopped them. A lot of terrible things were done on all sides in that war, just like in every war. But I think not fighting them would probably worse than fighting them was.
Sure.
Your standard role-playing evil empire is probably at least a little bit based off of the Nazis, if for no other reason than that's such a powerful and compelling recent historical example that a lot of people who are writing settings or GMs that are coming up with their own have that percolating in the back of their head from high school history class or movies that they've watched or whatever else have you. And so I think it is possible to be a good person and still employ violence. I think that we mentioned in our first episode, Lieutenant Colonel Dave Grossman's sheepdog archetype, the people that are protective of others with their capacity for violence. And I think that's one of the things that you may want to strive to portray if you're going to play like good warrior type of character. I only draw my sword when I need to protect somebody. You do not lash out in anger. You don't harm people just because it's convenient. If you're going to go to that extent, it has to mean something. I think also a lack of violence doesn't necessarily mean virtue either. As I mentioned in one of our earlier episodes, I live in Illinois. Here in Illinois, our last two governors are both in prison. Our current one is not. He may be the first one not to go to prison in... geez, when did George Ryan's term start? It's been a while. To the best of my knowledge, neither George Ryan nor Rod Blagojevich have ever done any serious physical harm to a person directly themselves. But corruption can sometimes be even worse. I know if you are powerful and you structure things where policy benefits you personally, if you're a king or a politician or even just a boss in a job, at the expense of people underneath you, that's not good and virtuous behavior, even if nobody is physically hurt. Those can make for interesting characters to have as adversaries because, hey, they're quote-unquote not hurting anybody, and they'll even say that themselves, but the damage they're doing to the society they're in is immense.
Yeah. You know, we say they're good villains, good antagonists in our stories. I'm not entirely averse to letting a player play a character like that, assuming, you know, with the understanding that part of that character's growth is understanding and rectifying the problems that they've created for themselves and for others through that behavior.
In fact, that would be an extremely compelling character story. You've got a nonviolent type of villainous person. Go back to the Christmas Carol thing, Ebenezer Scrooge.
Sure.
Watching his transformation is, you know, you start out a little bit skeptical or almost scoffing at him, and then as the story progresses and he truly transforms, that's some powerful stuff at the end. When he realizes the misery that his life has left, and ultimately how meaningless being that selfish is, and realizes that he's been given the second chance and rushes off to undo all of the hurt and suffering that he's done. That's some impactful stuff.
It is. And I like the idea of letting a player play a character who has significant temporal power, who originally doesn't understand the proper use for that, uses it for themselves, and learns to use it better, to be a better person with what they've been given. To put it in more Christian terms, be a better steward of what they've been entrusted with. And grow a character that way instead of a, what's the word, traditional, stereotypical...
where the numbers just go up on your character sheet?
Not even that, but character growth from horrible person to better person, upholder of the righteous, that sort of thing. It'd be interesting to see somebody go through a more complicated transition like that. where the temptations of everyday life fall away and somebody and a character really understands, this is what I should be doing, this is what's meaning.
So we've mentioned redemption. Should we talk a little bit about falling from grace here too, or?
Sure.
Do you have any examples that you'd like to throw on this one, or do you want me to start?
Go ahead and start.
Okay. So I suppose you could do this with a player character, although I'm not sure I'd really recommend it. I think this would be incredibly depressing. But where sometimes, just as in real life, people will start out good and get corrupted by something and become worse people, that can happen in role-playing games too, and I think it can be a useful narrative device, having the villain for a story be somebody who starts out basically good, maybe gets a little bit more power or influence than they can handle, and slowly has that power start corrupting them. Could make for a particularly sympathetic and tragic antagonist for PCs to go up against, and one that I think, especially if you have somebody who started out good, fell, and is kind of miserable in the state that they're in, that can be a lot of in-game motivation for characters to attempt to redeem the person back to where they used to be, rather than just cutting them down.
Yeah, I think so. I think there's a lot of value there. And again, maybe I'm just more willing to throw players out there and let them try this. I think it'd be interesting to see a player play a character who starts with noble intention, falls from grace, and then is redeemed through some manner and comes back a stronger person for having gone through that darkened period. And that certainly echoes the Christian story very strongly. We fall from God's grace and then are redeemed through Christ.
I think that also follows the story of a lot of us individual Christians as we go through our lives. I know it sure did with me. I started out as a little kid. I was raised in the church. I was taught proper modes of behavior by my parents, and I was pretty good about that until I hit my teenage years. I went through a little bit of a darker period like a lot of us do, where I really kind of questioned what I'd been taught and learned to deal with all these new hormones that were surging through my system, making me selfish and lustful and all kinds of other fun things, and then found my way back to my faith as I got a little bit older. And I think it's probably a little more genuine and a little less judgmental than it would be otherwise for having gone through some of the struggles that I went through.
Sure. And kind of going through that similar sort of thing right now, or at least I'm trying to. In high school, I was very religious. Kind of had a little bit of a moment of religious epiphany and studied Christianity and Christian belief. Tried to read the Bible regularly and really was trying to be a very good Christian. And then got into college, went through fairly serious depressive episodes for various reasons that I've talked about before. Kind of went through some other things, got a job, focusing on making enough to feed my family, that sort of thing, and just sort of lost track of all of that. And now I'm trying to find my way back to, maybe not where I was, but to a deeper, better relationship with Christ, having gone through a period where I can look back now and say, I don't want that anymore. I don't want that to be my life. I want something better, and I know where to get it. I just have to build myself up to the point where I can face where that comes from and what that means. That's one of the reasons I'm doing this podcast. I want to explore that and to find my way back to Christ using some of the tools that I've got at my disposal through role-playing games and just talking about it and learning about it from doing this.
You've mentioned that a couple of times, but just for the record, listeners, don't think I'm not getting anything out of this, too. I've definitely been through some rough times in my life where I was very outwardly Christian, but my life, my internal life and sometimes my private actions didn't always reflect what I professed. I've been in a process over my whole life, if I'm really going to be honest, of trying to make the inside match, to make the walk match the talk, I guess, is probably the best way of putting it.
And we all go through phases like that, and I think it's an interesting thing about Christianity. As we get better at understanding what proper Christian behavior is and understand our relationship to Christ better, we understand more and more how bad we still are. C.S. Lewis in Mere Christianity, I think, describes it very well. To quote him here, "When a man is getting better, he understands more and more clearly the evil that is still left in him. When a man is getting worse, he understands his own badness less and less. A moderately bad man knows he is not very good. A thoroughly bad man thinks he is all right."
Huh. That's a great quote.
It is. C.S. Lewis, as usual, is a good quote. It goes on from there, but I've seen that very clearly in my own life. the times when I think I'm being a good Christian are usually the times I'm least Christian, both in my own life and in my relationship with others. And those are the most dangerous moments for me. Those times when I'm most keenly aware of how far I have to go, I can set my own self aside and think most about God and what God wants. That's something in many ways unique to Christianity, and something that Christians, I think, should collectively sort of watch for any time you start feeling that sense of pride in your own purity and your own rightness with God. Maybe that's time to start watching out.
Yeah.
And to pull this back to role-playing games, I think we can use that to model, I think, an interesting character progression of the times when the character isn't really on the right track but thinks they are.
And I think on that note, I think we've got a pretty good episode here. What do you think, Grant?
I think so, too. Oh, wait. One last thing I did want to talk about. Using alignment as a character creation shortcut. We've kind of talked about having alignment as a very simplified method of expressing a complex character. I don't think it's particularly a bad thing, though, to use an existing simple alignment system to at least come up with a starting point for a character. To say, I want a character that's sort of like this, but in this way, not that way, and develop it from there. But it's a useful shortcut, and I don't think it's cheating. I don't think it's a bad thing to start with something very simple and something well-known to create a character.
Yeah, in fact, I've used it when I was creating characters and systems that didn't even have alignment. It's like, I'm envisioning this character as kind of neutral good, doesn't always necessarily care what the actual rules are as long as he can help people who need it. And it's like, okay, so what does that look like in this, and what kind of other neat quirks and traits and ethics might this character have?
Right. And I've used it actually in D&D and Pathfinder to kind of start with a character, start with an archetype, and then switch it around, come up with something interesting and clever. Okay, I want this particular character class, or this particular thing or skill that's usually evil. How can I make that a good thing? How can I make that somebody who's accepted in society? For example, we were planning a fairly ridiculous campaign with incredible detail and economic modeling, and I think we were going to be...
Well, your group does run really long games, so...
Yeah, no, this was like tracking seasonal crop production level of ridiculousness.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, it was going to be fairly impressive. Thankfully, that fell through, honestly. I'm not sure I'd be up for it. Certainly not now. But, you know, the character I had in mind for that, I kind of started with, what's one thing in D&D that I haven't really done that I think's neglected? Poison. Poison's interesting. It's normally evil. How can I make a good poisoner? Well, okay, maybe in this society, you go hunting, you need somebody who can make poisons to hunt more effectively, to bring in food, you know, somebody who makes herbs and drugs to numb pain for crude surgeries, that sort of thing, and sort of developed a character and a role in this society we were inventing, where something that was traditionally sort of evil kind of got turned on its head and became a respected part of society in that particular culture we were building. Based some of that on very tribal traditions of people going hunting with poisoned arrow or blowgun or something like that. Knowing how to make a poison like that is not, you know, oh, you're some evil poisoner. It's, oh, yeah, you're feeding your family.
I need to bring down this huge, shaggy beast that could gore me if it got too close in order to feed my village. So I'm going to scrape my arrow along the back of this frog first and... Yeah.
Right. Just kind of a more advanced poison-making sort of thing. Just part of the whole D&D character class that I chose and all that sort of thing, which I don't want to get into. And you came up with sort of an interesting character and role in society because I took something that traditionally has an alignment associated with it, poison being almost always evil in D&D, and said, okay, how can I turn this around? And thus, how can I make that interesting? I think there's a lot of value in that, and don't be afraid to use that in any game to come up with at least an interesting starting point. Flesh it out according to whatever game you're playing, but don't be afraid to say, I'm kind of feeling more chaotic good with this character than lawful good today, with a character I want to explore. Let's start there and narrow it down from there. On that note, Peter, do you have anything else?
Nope, I think we can close this one up for the evening. Thanks for listening, everybody. Remember, we've got a website, a Facebook page, a Google Plus group, a Twitter account. You can find links to all of this on our website, savingthegamepodcast.org. So come visit us and start a conversation with us in one of those places. We'd love to hear from you.
If you've got any questions, comments, topic suggestions, anything like that, get in touch with us through any of those methods Peter's just described. We'd be more than happy to listen to you. On that note, folks, have a good evening, or good morning, or whatever.
And we'll see you next time on Saving the Game.
This has been a production of Saving the Game, copyright 2012. This podcast may be redistributed under a Creative Commons non-commercial, non-derivative license, provided that credit is given to savingthegamepodcast.org. Our music is by Ryan Humphrey. For past episodes, podcast news from our hosts, or to connect with us, visit our website at savingthegamepodcast.org. God bless, and happy gaming.